Hello and welcome to recording number 10 of Gary Gygax's Sea of Death, an annotated reading. Today is September 10th, 2021. All right, we've just had Gord making his way south past the area of the Yolsprue Mountains and over the hills, and now he's, I think, just in the dry steppes area. So what we've run into is Gord, as he's camping, there are some Paynim who come, and there's just three of them, and he invites them to his camp. They were thinking of ambushing him, but Gord proved too threatening to them. So they made him one of the tribe, and then tried to extort gifts out of him, which Gord refused, took a very antagonistic stand against. And then they're riding south, and they run into a group of Yolites, as they call them, or Olites, and there's a battle begins. And then the group of Paynim that they were waiting for at this appointed place shows up, and then the Yolites are now being defeated. And then all of a sudden, it seemed like probably either Eclavdra's or Obmi's group was in league with the Yolites and came and has attacked them. And they're tracking Gord down, which I'm not 100% sure. One might think that he's either Obmi or Eclavdra. You know, they might have thought that that was another contestants group because they followed him for a couple days. And then he encounters another group called the Arodin. Now, I'm not sure which culture they're from. They take Gord prisoner. And I wanted to speak about that because I was addressing it yesterday. But at this point, Sea of Death is a new Infinities book. And I'm not sure whether Gygax is still using AD&D as a background for everything that's going on. I think he's either fooling around with a different system or he's gone to really storytelling mode. Gord is captured. The first, they're able to sneak up on him, which I found very unbelievable. And then they are able to capture him by throwing lariats around him. Which again, I thought, well, Gord turned and ran, which, you know, I thought was ridiculous, but also that then he's captured very quickly by these nomads. And, you know, Gord at this point is, you know, well beyond something like that happening in a normal game. And usually Gygax is pretty good at explaining why. All right, well, Gord is captured with these lariats, and they're going to sell him off. Now, there's introducing two kind of cultures in this area. There's these nomadic Aradin, and they may be Paynims, but they may be a different tribe of Paynims than the ones he had encountered earlier. But I'm not sure who they are offhand. And then they want to sell him in a town, in a slave market, and to a place that uses slaves for mining. So there's definitely two different cultures here, and perhaps a third. There might be the town culture, the people who own the mine, and these nomads. And so it's going to take several days for them to take Gord to wherever this town is to sell in the slave market. And the first night, and he jumps ahead and has a couple nights go by, and it's just absolutely absurd. Gord can transform into a tomcat. He can transform into a leopard. He can also, disentangle himself from knots and stuff as part of his training and his acrobatics and all these things that he's learned. But at the very least, he could turn into a tomcat and he'd no longer be tied up. So at this point in the story, it's again one of these things where it's like, I don't know exactly what Gygax is doing, because he's making it seem like Gord can't escape from these simple ropes. He can see in the dark as a cat, and you know, so at this point in the story, we're moving ahead, but we've reached this little point where I don't find the story, you know, I find it falls down a little right here. All right, so I'm going to continue. And, yeah, here's a commentary. It's like characters forgetting their abilities. I've done more than once. And maybe Egg forgot. But part of, you know, writing a book is go back and review things. And Gygax had previously been a very... you know, very astute at, you know, knowing what to, what Gord could do, and, you know, knowing, like, something would happen, and then I'd wonder what was happening there, and then a page or two later, Gygax would explain it. So maybe Gygax will explain it further on, but right here, I think the story's fallen down a little bit. All right, it's page 114, and it is the second paragraph from the end. Although he was treated roughly by his captors, and riding a camel proved to be sheer torture for him at first, Gord was given food and water whenever the Rodan ate and drank. After a couple of days, the young adventurer became fairly accustomed to his strange mount, and the pain of his sore muscles lessened enough so that Gord was able to actually pay attention to his surroundings as he rode. The land they passed over was similar to that which he and Windeater had encountered before. The guard on Gord's right flank, Brodri by name, had shown himself to be a bit more sociable than the others. In other words, Gord could occasionally speak to him and get an answer other than a growl and a painful blow. When the young captive saw that they were no longer heading south, he risked punishment and asked Brodri about it. "We now go more eastward than south," Gord said without expression. "There are caravans near Gastor who trade. Don't be stupid. The Rodan warriors take what they need from the Yoli," Veiled Warrior said, turning his head to speak directly at the captive. "Such men as you, a Rodan, can surely do that," Gord said with a note of humiliation in his voice. "But surely the swarms of Yolite horsemen resist that. Are so few real warriors as this able to overcome the many who must protect such caravans? Sometimes there are only a few guards. Sometimes others of our people join us." "Stop chattering like a woman. This command came from one of the lieutenants of the warrior band." Brodri shot an angry glance at Gord when he was rebuked, and with this he turned to face forward and spoke no more. What the nomad had told him, however, gave Gord some slight hope. A fight, or even the confusion of new warriors joining the group who held him captive, might allow him the chance he needed. The Aradan warriors rode in a broad arc. Their path curved to the southeast, and their pace was now slow. A dozen scouts trotted to the left, and an equal number rode ahead, all of them beyond sight of the main body of camel riders. It was evident that the leader, Yahud, was looking for a passing caravan, just as Brodri had said. Nothing occurred that day, though. The next morning they turned due east, for the rising sun was directly in his eyes as Gord was hoisted up to begin his day's ride with his feet, as usual, lashed under the camel's belly. Near the end of the day, Gord detected a line of undulating darkness on the faraway southern horizon, a stretch of hills he suspected. The nomad stopped and went through the usual camping routines. Gord watched for an opening as usual, but the Aroden guards were as alert as they had always been. young adventurer forgot about thoughts of escape for the time being and slept as comfortably as his bonds permitted. Tomorrow was another day. The veiled nomad swung southward the next morning, riding perhaps 2 leagues in that direction. Now Gord noticed mountains to his left hand, perhaps the Bering Ridge, but he wasn't sure. And the Aradan abruptly turned and headed their camels west, sweeping back toward the area they had come from. Gord was perplexed by this, and decided to probe Brodri for information. "We now ride for Carnoush?" he asked. The nomad stared hard at Gord for a moment. Then his visage softened slightly, and he said, "It is only because you might have our blood, blood of the Aradan, that I speak to you. I would not wish to die in slavery either, Outlander. Carnoush lies to the south, several days' ride. We will make for the city, but as we do, we will travel eastward and westward as well. Our sheikh seeks prey, so we sweep the land for Yoli, or others who are so bold as to ride through the land of the Aradan. There are others who are your foes here then, too. Of course, many come and go to and from Lake Carnoush, and the rich markets of the bazaar there. Anims, Yoli, and the dark Jahindi all travel to and from that place. Even the folk of Sahan and Bihau are seen at Carnoush. We abide most of these visitors, requiring only that they pay us in goods and livestock when we run across them. But when the dogs of Yol dare to pass over our lands, they are subject to our special tariff. Tariff? Wondering in death, Brodri said with a thin, grim smile. All right, break. Okay, Chris has put it up. This is a map, the little map here. Carnoush, you see a little lake there in the middle of the what are being called the Barren Plains. K is Carnoush. Six is Carnoush. I guess the K might be Lake Carnoush. Seven is Tashbol. Ow. Were you going to say something, Chris?
Yes, K is Lake Carnoush. You're right.
All right. Okay. So can you slap the Darlene map up there? Because I'm really sick of the new Infinities names myself. All right, so we know now that the Aradan are not the Paynim. They're going to be the natives of the plains here. Yeah, now, I did want to speak about this. There's a question about the Jahindi. Not only that, but, all right, so they're talking about several things. It's the dry steppes, and we see the exact lakes right there. Okay, so there's a city by there in the dry steppes. And I had thought that the nomads of the dry steppes had also been Paynim, but these Aradan are separate from them. And, all right, and so we have the people of Carnoush. There's some kind of mines, which may be all the way down in the Solhoop Mountains. Now, there's on this map, there's actually different things down there against the Solhoop Mountains, including passes that these people know how to get over into the Sea of Dust, and that they raid the outer ruins, and they know something of the strange kind of life forms that live in the Sea of Dust. Now, it's been brought up here that there's definitely three names that have been mentioned, and they're mentioned later on too, but the Dark Jahindi, that is Gygax's... Gygax was talking about the western part of, the continent here. And they are supposed to have at least these three peoples, the Jahindi, folk of Sahan, and Bihau. Now, I assume the Jahindi are supposed to be, obviously, Hindus. And then the Sahan and the Bihau, I believe, are supposed to be Chinese and perhaps, I'm not sure, I don't know if they're supposed to be Japanese or just Chinese and people from, you know, other Asian people from that area right there. You know, they could be Vietnamese, they could be Korean, but definitely we have three cultures being mentioned right here that are Earth equivalents, which is, you know, it's what Gygax like to do. So, you know, they are definitely talking about, you know, similarities with Earth, and then we run across that throughout these books and throughout the original setting and everything. You know, Hepmonoland's supposed to be, I guess, like Africa, and the Olman Isles are supposed to be like Central America and such. And I don't know about the southern portion of Hepmonoland. That could even be plains with people who are like American Indians. So, you know, there's all these cultural equivalencies. And here we have mentions definitely of the Hindi types in two Asian cultures. And that they come this far out, that they're encountered at this lake here in the dry steppes in Carnoush. Now, if you look at the Darlene map, there is a color difference between real deserty areas and then the plains. And the areas that are within like 100 miles of that lake and then further, they are colored light green on Darlene's map, meaning that they're grassy plains, while the dry steppes have the same desert hex look that even the Sea of Dust has. But obviously from Gord's description, they're not quite the same. There was mention of herd animals, and there was mention that Wind Eater, his horse, was able to find long grass to roll in and grass to eat. So it's not completely inhospitable. The oddest thing I found from yesterday was the mention of cactus. Now, I'm pretty sure that you only find cactus in the Western Hemisphere. I'm not sure it's found anywhere else in the world. Right. So, you know, this is quite a little bit of information we have right here. But I'm still unsure who the Aradan are supposed to be. It's page 117, the second paragraph. I'm going to restart here. Very next day, just such an encounter occurred. Running camels, their curious side-to-side gait still seeming strange to Gord, despite the time he himself had been riding one, brought a handful of the veiled Aradan scouts back to the main body. He shouted that Yoli were coming toward them from the north. "There are many animals laden with goods, Sheikh," one warrior called, and then added, "many slaves, women slaves, but the dogs have many guards with them too." Ahoud immediately called in his lieutenants and held a council. When this broke up, Gord overheard the plan that was passed down to his guards by their leader. "We will wait for darkness, for those cowardly mongrels do not like to fight when they can't see to use their bows. When we halt at dusk, keep that one wrapped well," the veiled warrior said, nodding toward Gord. "All but one of you four must come with us when we attack." "No one wants to lose the honor and spoils," one of the guards remarked. "Which of us must stay?" "The other groups of sentries are drawing lots," said the lieutenant, as he turned to ride away. "You can do the same, or settle it any other way you wish, so long as no one is injured." Guards decided to leave the question to chance, and the other three insisted that Brodri draw last, since he was the youngest. To no one's great surprise, Brodri lost. He was furious and insisted he'd been cheated. But of course the others would not admit to such a thing. Gord did not say a word during the rest of that day's riding, knowing full well that Brodri was in no mood for talking. That night Gord stayed awake, but silent until several minutes after the Aradan horde had ridden out to take on the Yoli. He knew that Brodri was still furious, but tried to approach him with a question. Pardon me. All right. A question anyway. And got a kick in the ribs for his trouble. Keep that wagging tongue still, or by lightning and wind, I'll tear it out of your head, young guard screamed. So Gord thought it wasn't going to be possible for him to draw Brodrian to talk, and then persuade the guard to loosen his bonds a bit. He would have to play a waiting game instead, and as it turned out, the wait was not a long one. I'll break right here. I like the little oath here, by lightning and wind. So that's one of the oaths of the Aradon that they use. Again, I am really dumbfounded by why Gord cannot simply transform his way out of this. It really strikes me that this is, Gygax wants this to happen. So it seems like he's simply going, against his own logical consistency here. And I find that annoying. I wish he would. Gord should never have been caught in the first place. And for him to have been surprised like that, it was just ridiculous. And then for him now, that it be days bound up when he can transform into a house cat, I find. Gygax wants this story to go a certain way, and I find this a little heavy-handed right here. All right, it's page 118 and the second paragraph. Gord kept his peace for another few minutes while Brodrey sat nearby, facing his prisoner and brooding. Then the guard's expression changed to one of resignation. He stood up, looked around, went a few paces over to his gear, and pulled out a small pot. Gord could smell the heady odor of date wine, as Brodrey sat down in front of him again and swigged occasionally from the container. The container was drained in less than half an hour. Brodrey stood, belched, heaved the empty wine pot disgustedly to one side, and stumbled heavily off to Gord's left, looking for a place to relieve himself. Possibly Brodrey believed that the many loops of cord and complex knots were sufficient to skewer the prisoner. Possibly the potent wine had made him incautious. Whatever caused him to be careless in the first place, Brodrey made an even greater mistake when he heard the sounds of fighting coming faintly over the still night air of the arid land, and his ears picked up the distant yells and din of battle wafting in from the north. The warrior ran several dozen yards farther away from Gord, in the direction of the sounds, in hopes of hearing more clearly. Gord had already managed to loosen his bonds somewhat during the 2 minutes when Brodrey had been busy relieving himself. Literally the only occasion on which the young thief had been left unsupervised since he was captured. In the time it took Brodrey to cover the additional distance, and then stand for a moment with his ear cocked toward the faraway sound, Gord finished the job of getting free, and quickly and noiselessly crept up behind the careless guard, one of the ropes that tethered him held fast in his hand. A barely audible choking noise was the last sound Brodrey made, just before the rope Gord had drawn around his throat cut off the noise, and his breath all at once. Gord felt a slight pang of regret as Brodrey's body slumped to the ground, for this Aradon was the closest he had had to a friend during his captivity. But even at that, thought the young thief, it was certainly not the sort of friendship that was bound to last. Strengthening his resolve to its fullest once again, he bent over the corpse and claimed the nomad's longsword and heavy-bladed dagger. Now Gord felt a lot better. He owed these Aradon much, and tonight he would repay them for their kind hospitality. He wanted to get back his belongings, and using his special night sight and his keen ears, he did not see or hear any guards around the warriors' tents, including the one belonging to Sheikh Yahud, where he supposed his gear would be stored. But Gord didn't go there immediately. assumed that there would be sentries stationed with the pack animals and horses to keep them from hurting themselves or straying away. They wanted no men in the camp left alive when he searched the Sheikh's cloth shelter for his precious gear. His reasoning was correct. After creeping along the perimeter of the camp, using tents and shrubs to conceal his movements, he detected two guards in the area where the remaining camels and the horses were tied on a long line. First he struck from behind using the unfamiliar but deadly sword. The nomad never knew what happened. He was dead before his body fell to the sandy ground he had been walking on a moment prior. The sound of his collapse alerted his comrade, however, and the other Aradan warrior called out. "What is wrong?" laughed Dan. "Missed," Gord replied, allowing the indistinct sound to trail off. The nomad crouched and came cautiously toward the noise that had risen out of the darkness. He moved with all the stealth of any of his kind, and his sword was held ready before him as he advanced. The maneuver did him no good, for Gord had already flanked him and came to the attack from his left. The Rodden, sensing the young thief's silent rush, tried to bring his blade around at the last second. Both sword and dagger struck before he could defend himself. Choking on his own blood, the veiled warrior followed his comrade to wherever dead warriors of the Rodden go. "Air slaver, is your pay for the work you have done," Gord muttered bitterly. Not bothering with either dead sentry further, Gord went swiftly to the rows of tents and sought out the largest one, which was Yahud's. In his haste, he pulled aside the flap covering the entrance and almost ran directly into the sword of the warrior on guard inside. The man's sword slashed through the air as he lunged forward, and Gord had to throw himself sideways to avoid a mortal wound. As it was, he suffered a long, shallow cut. The nomad followed up his advantage, slashing and stabbing so furiously that it was all the young adventurer could do to avoid another wound, while he retreated back out of the cramped confines of the tent's entryway. Once the battle was carried to the outside, Gord's opponent got his blade caught for a moment in one of the ropes that held a nearby tent, and as he freed it, Gord managed to spring back and take a proper position. Then the two engaged in a fencing match. All right, break. So, right here, you know, I am just thinking that it's, you know, I'm pretty sure he's no longer using AD&D, and all the things we could assume from the earlier books, it kind of thrown out the window then, because if Gord's level no longer matters, and it goes over to story, and there's going to be, you know, different kinds of fighting going on, because once we're out of the simulation of AD&D combat, that, you know, where a wound isn't a hit point loss isn't a wound. So if Gord is just a skilled adventurer and with powers, but not necessarily, you know, like a hit point machine, as a high level character and, you know, is able to, you know, defeat several of these low-level characters quite easily, then it changes the structure of the story so that, you know, one arrow could kill somebody. One strike could kill somebody. So I am thinking here, I mean, there's also, I don't know, Gygax maybe did not have a very good editor here. And I wonder if Gygax switched over to GURPS for these books. Because one of the things, now this isn't about GURPS, but the guard in the tent should have had a harder time, edited by Kim Mohan, should have had a much harder time swinging at Gord inside the tent, especially with a large sword. than Gord would have had with the dagger, or even I don't know, maybe he's wielding a large sword himself, but it would have been much harder fighting inside the tent than worrying about the ropes on the outside. So I, you know, that just seemed to me a little out of place right there. All right. And this was, it's Chris Notes. This was edited by Kim Moen. And I know Kim did editing work, you know, but I don't know how much that was just for setting adventures. It's a whole different, kettle of fish to edit a novel or a piece of fiction. So I don't know how much experience there was there, or how much they wanted to really criticize Gygax. So, you know, right here, I'm kind of just... some of the fights have been extremely, extremely well done. I'm just a little disappointed in this. All right, and I'm going to restart. And so it is page 120 in the final paragraph. Contest was silent except for the ring of steel on steel. Rodden must have known that either the noise of fighting alone would be sufficient to summon his fellows, or that no amount of noise would help. So he saved his breath and fought without outcry. Within seconds, both combatants realized that no other men remained in camp, no live ones at any rate. Nomad was a little taller than Gord and very skilled. Whether or not a contest in daylight with equal weapons would eventually have gained the warrior a victory, Gord wasn't sure. But the young adventurer was in no mood for gallantry and honorable tests of arms at this point. The Aradan had taken him, stolen all his precious possessions, and thought to sell him into a short life of slavery and death for a few bits of silver. Revenge and recovery of what was his were the only thoughts in Gord's mind as he acted. With a lightning-like flick of his wrist, Gord brought the heavy dagger down. His arm shot outward as he did so, and the weapon flew from his hand, point first. The sharp point of the blade hit where he had aimed, embedding itself in the bicep of the veiled man's sword arm, just as he was bringing forward his weapon, for a sweeping cut targeted at Gord's neck. "Arg!" the nomad cried, a half-stifled sound of pain as the dagger pierced his flesh. The stroke could not be held, and neither could the warrior's grip on his sword hilt. Gord ducked, but need not have done so. The long blade went flying on an incline into the darkness, sailing well over and past the young adventurer's head with a whirring sound. Aradin tried to continue the fight, standing his ground and reaching for his dagger with his sound left arm. But with two sword slashes and a final dagger thrust, Gord cut him down. It took only a little time for Gord to locate the Aradin Sheikh's hidden wealth. It was buried, of course, and kept safe in a locked chest. Gord had it out from under the carpet and the dirt quickly. Used the longsword to hack the container open, for he feared that poison needles protected its lock. He had no time or desire to try to use his skill as a thief to defeat any protections that might have been built into the Nomad Chief's strongbox. Inside were all of his treasures, except for his shirt of magical elfin mail. "Saw Yahood, you like my armor, do you?" he said aloud, as he buckled on his short sword and tucked his enchanted dagger back into its sheath. "Let us see how much good it does you when my long fang poignard here kisses your lousy body." His ring, his armband, his sling, and all of his other possessions were here as well. He savored each thing as he reclaimed and donned it. Adding a largest leather pouch full of coins to what he had recovered of his own, Gord ran out of the tent and headed back for where the animals were kept. He was curious about what was happening in the battle to the north. Besides that, he was not yet done with revenge. With luck, it might be possible to find Yahud in a position where he had only a few of his warriors around him. If that happened, Gord vowed he would risk the odds to even the score with the Aradan Sheikh. All right, so people may notice that as Gord's looting, he finds his ring. And just before, just as he was captured, Gygax made a point of saying that Gygax was now using the abilities of the ring without wearing it. So Gygax doesn't even have to have the ring on Gygax. Gord does not even have to have the ring on him to make use of it. Now, he didn't specifically change into a leopard, but he talked about doing it. And he worried that he couldn't change quick enough without being killed, even though as the leopard, he's a were-leopard and immune to magical weapons. And he worried that they might have magical weapons. But all in all, I find this entire situation, you know, it's just Gygax wanted it to be this way, so it was, whether it makes sense or not. So I still don't think, and he could have had something about where he lost the abilities if he wasn't wearing the ring. So I don't know why he made a point of saying that Gygax still had the, Gord still had the abilities when not wearing the ring. It just, you know, I don't understand why he did that with this story. So I'm going to restart. It's page 122 and the second paragraph down. Windeater recognized him as soon as he came near the stallion. It was a simple matter to untether him, then find and put on his saddle. Just before Gord broke camp, so to speak, he cut the rope that held the camels and other horses together. Then he galloped Windeater along their length, hooting and waving his arms as he went. Frightened dromedaries and equines ran off in all directions, and horse and rider pounded off toward the sounds that still came faintly from the north. After about 20 minutes of hard riding, Gord brought Windeater to a halt atop a low rise. A few hundred yards in the distance, he could see the Yoli encampment. Spread out in an arc along the flat ground were clusters of Aradan. From this vantage point, Gord could see that the camp was about two-thirds surrounded. Inside the camp, several unwinking lights glowed brightly. They looked like magical globes of illumination, evidently cast by the Yoli sometime during the combat. There had probably been more, but Gord supposed that the Aradan had priests and shamans of their own. To counter such light with magically wrought darkness. A few burning tents added a flickering glow to the steady brightness of the inspelled light spheres. Even though his night sight did not operate at such long distances, Gord could discern what was going on in the camp, and some of what had transpired thanks to this strange combination of illumination. It appeared that at one point the attacking force must have been right among the defenders. There were bodies dressed in pale ochre robes of the Aradan strewn throughout the camp. Many Yolites had died there, too. Because of what he was now witnessing, the young adventurer assumed that the defenders had managed to push back the first onslaught of the Veiled Warriors. He saw no combat activity within the camp, but with every passing minute, the Aradan were expanding the ends of their arc, and clearly intended to encircle the Yolite encampment. Beleaguered Yolites were lying low, for the attackers were sending buzzing bolts from their crossbows toward the camp. Any figure that showed itself in or against a light source was a target. Before the Yolites had needed the light to use their bows, just as the Aradan had suspected they would prefer to do, but now the illumination was a liability. The lit areas were being generally shunned. Gord could make out burned and smoking patches of ground here and there around the camp. If any spell workers still lived among the defenders, no sign of this was evident. Either their magic was exhausted, or these men had died after casting their spells. Gord wondered how many Yolai warriors remained. It was hard to tell from this distance. Gord tied Wind Eater to a scrubby bit of brush 100 paces away, in a place where an upthrust fold of ground would conceal the stallion's presence, unless someone came within 10 or so yards. Moving quietly down the slope, then working to his left, the young thief began moving toward the veiled warriors, who were besieging the camp. The Rodan strategy was a logical and unsurprising one. Encircling their enemy, they could contain them and also gain maximum sniping advantage, just so long as the attackers were careful not to hit their allies on the other side of the circle with their crossbow fire. The Rodan camels were reined in small groups along the outside edge of the circle. The animals' senses had already been assaulted by so much commotion that they paid no heed to another man in their vicinity. And as Gord soon found out, the attackers themselves did not even consider that someone might be coming up behind them. It was so easy as to be almost laughable. Each of the Aradan warriors was stationed roughly 150 feet from the fringe of the Yoli encampment, and more importantly, each one was at least 75 feet, sometimes as much as 100, away from his nearest neighbor. Not enough space for the Yoli to attempt an escape as a group, but plenty of room for Gord to work undisturbed. A break. That just does not seem, you know, particularly realistic to me either. That there's only, you know, one of these Aradan every 75 to 100 feet. You know, that is actually, you know, it's certainly not enough if these Yolai and whoever's with them just got together, and these are dismounted men, and if they all got together on their mounts and rode for it, they would just ride over that small group of men in their way. It's Gygax is really, you know, experienced wargamer, and I just does not make sense to me that he'd think that'd be enough to stop them from running for it. And at this point, it would seem like the best tactic to try to make a break for it in a mass and just take some casualties on their way out. So, again, you know, I'm waiting to hear. I was glad to hear that Gygax did make note of crossfire. And normally, you do not attack directly, you know, like, you don't face each other with missile weapons. You know, what you do is you have, you know, one side, one group who comes in like a straight line, and the other is oblique to that, so that they're not going to be, you know, not going to be crossing their missile fire into each other. You know, like every miss is a potential hit of someone on your side. Of course, they're not massed together. And the big thing about early combat was that most weapons were meant for massed combat. You weren't, you know, there were, you know, people who were expert archers and such, you know, who individually could go out, but none of these weapons had, you know, huge range. And, you know, like, that's the thing with magic users. They can have incredibly powerful weapons, and it doesn't do to be bunched together when hit by them, but these kind of fighters should be massed together. You have the protection of shield walls. You have the accuracy of missile weapons, which is very poor, so that you group together and fire as a group at a solid group in hopes of hitting someone. So you know, I don't know. I'm maybe being too critical, but I just I find this very strange for as experienced historical military historian as Gygax and also as a war gamer. I mean, because in war games, there's a very practical effect to these things that if you have men in a skirmish line, they, like these are, this is a skirmish line spread out so far, they are not effective except to, harass the enemy rather than do anything like stop a mass retreat or mass exit. So I'm really surprised at all this. All right, I'm going to restart, and it is on page 124, and it is paragraph, second paragraph from the end. Yeah, and there's a question here. Was he under pressure just to get these books done? I'm even wondering if he wrote all of this. Like this section here, I just wonder if this was maybe they put together from like notes or framework, and certain things he left to other people to finish. Like, you know, there could be a note like there's a battle here, and let them finish it as they wanted to. Or like this whole section could have been Gord is captured, you know, there's a battle. Gord's captured, there's a battle, Gord escapes, and left off the details to someone else, because this seems uncharacteristically unsensible for Gygax, who normally is very good at this detail work. And I do wonder how much pressure there was. And I also think this may have been a manuscript he had unfinished when he left TSR. Maybe they had to, yeah, like Chris says, New Infinities needed money. Maybe they threw this out there really quick for the money. Now, overall, there's been some fantastic stuff in here, some good fights and that. But I'm just, at this point right here, it just doesn't seem like, even Gygax trying to do it quickly would have written this right here. This, I don't know, maybe somebody else who's more, also another war gamer, knows more about this kind of Middle Eastern fight. But it just seems like this is a skirmish line, and, you know, I've been a war gamer since I was 9 years old, and, you know, I've been a like Gygax, an amateur, historical, especially about war historians. So, I just don't think this is right. All right, and I'm dwelling on it too much. I'm going to move ahead here. It is page 124, and it is the second paragraph from the end. He picked a spot in the loosely spaced circle to begin, and then moved relentlessly along the Aradan rank. He killed as silently as the whisper of an owl's wing, as swiftly as the nocturnal predator does when its great talon strike an unsuspecting rat. From one of the first men he felled, Gord appropriated an attractive-looking necklace. Then, as he went on, he amused and revenged himself by stripping many of his victims of the silver bracelets they wore, stringing them on the necklace as he went along. Old habits die hard, Gord thought to himself as he did this, but the Aradan were certainly dying a lot more easily. Break. And this is kind of my history teacher in high school was a Korean War veteran. And he'd always admired the Turks, because during the Korean War, what the Turks like to do is they like to slip out at night from their camps and go out and go and fight with knives. So they just go out and do exactly what Gord is doing right here. They'd slip among the Vietnamese and the Viet Cong and come back in the morning after killing during the night with knives. So this is, you know, it's an example here of what's going on and exactly why you don't have your men spaced out singly like this. It is just, ridiculous. And so Gord here is able to slaughter them. All right. I am going to restart. It's page 124 in the final paragraph. One of the men he did in was Yahud himself, and he was careful to take this man with a dagger thrust in the neck so that he could reclaim his mail shirt in whole and in unharmed condition. Ward's only regret was that he had had to strike the sheikh from behind to kill him quickly, and thus the Aradan leader never knew by whose hand he died. He lost exact count after a time. Gord thought that he had managed to slay no fewer than a score of the veiled men, and had worked his way around about a quarter of the circle. Then his presence was noticed, but not by those whom he was killing. It was his own success that proved his undoing. Lack of missile fire from the segment where Gord had been wrecking his revenge must have become apparent to the besieged Yoli. A brief, tentative movement in that direction by a group of Yolites failed to bring any reaction from the attackers, and unbeknownst to those along the circle, some intelligent leader among the defenders' ranks managed to spread the word of this development. As for the attackers, they were so widely spaced, and one side of the circle was so far from its opposite section, that they remained oblivious to the fact that their ranks had been thinned. The closest Gord came to discovery was when an occasional warrior remarked to himself that the comrade on his right must have used up his crossbow bolts, just before that man himself fell to Gord's blades. There was a sudden burst of activity in the center of the beleaguered encampment, but much of went on was shielded from the view of outsiders by tents and large canvas shields. Some of the Uradan continued to fire indiscriminately into the mass, but most of them held their fire and did what they could to prepare for what was sure to be a last desperate rush. And the rush began. It went in two directions at once. While expendable animals were driven out toward the side opposite Gord, a rush of men and animals headed toward the unguarded portion of the circle. The ploy was detected by the veiled nomads within a couple of minutes, when those on the still intact side of the circle realized what they were being attacked by. Shouts and cries traveled along the arc, and Arad and Shaban, stationed close to the gap in the circle, brought forth a globe of light to show his brethren what was happening. A brilliant sphere sprang into being not far from where Gord was crouching. A Rodden warrior, who would have been Gord's next victim, got to his feet nearby, shifting his attention from the onrushing Yoli to the strange sight the globe revealed. "It is the prisoner," the veiled nomad shouted, pointing his small crossbow at Gord and jerking the trigger to release a hasty shot at the young adventurer. "He's escaped the camp and slain Thoter." Shaft plucked at the baggy robe that covered Gord, but did him no harm. Gord shouted a curse at the fellow, ran forward and attacked without thinking. By this time he was mad with fighting lust and blood madness. The Rodden dropped his crossbow and defended himself with his sword. Before he died, the man managed to keep Gord occupied long enough to enable another and then another of his tribesmen to join the melee. Even as this occurred, the escaping Yoli saw that not only were their enemies caught totally unaware, but the Aradan were not nearly as many in number as they had made themselves seem to be. This knowledge offered the Bakluni fighters an opportunity to revenge themselves upon their hated foes. Spread out as they were, the Aradan would find it hard to regroup to counter the nucleus of warriors who had just broken through the encirclement and were now ready to fight ferociously again. While the non-combatants among their number rode pell-mell to escape, the warriors of Yol began to fan out along each side of the broken circle, riding down upon their dismounted enemies, and trampling and stabbing as they went. As the sound of hooves came toward him, Gord disengaged from the two Aradan who fought him and darted away from the scene. A half dozen mounted Yoli descended upon the place where he had been but a moment before. Two veiled warriors managed to unseat one of the Yolites, but they lived only long enough to see him trampled beneath the hooves of his cohort's mounts. All of the Aradan now knew what was happening, and many of them had regained their own mounts and began to form into groups. The fight was far from over, and it was anyone's guess as to what the final outcome would be. But Gord had no interest now. It was time for him to forget about thoughts of revenge, to get clear of the confused battle and ride away. He had no trouble getting back to the spot where he had left Windeater. Gord mounted the steed and rode off, heading along a route that angled away from the direct line of escape that most of the fleeing Yoli non-combatants had taken. He could not avoid the flight of these dozens of people entirely, for they had fanned out once they were away from the Rodden circle, and were heading in many different directions at once. Ord hadn't gone far when he saw the shape of a fallen horse outlined against the lighter-colored ground ahead of him. Farther in the distance, he heard the sound of several other horses, camels, and shouting riders heading away from where the fallen animal lay. The sound of steel on steel rang out intermittently from this cluster, and Gord assumed that some of the Aradan had broken off from the main battle to chase down the Yolites who were riding away. He slowed Windeater's pace. He saw no sense in coming too close to the fighting. At this point, the frenzy of killing had left him now, and Gord felt disgusted, nauseated, and exhausted. He was drained of emotion and strength, and what he wanted most now was a place where he could rest and regain his energy. As he came within about 20 yards of the fallen horse, a high-pitched but tentative cry rang out, "Help!" Gord reined Windeater to a halt and peered intently toward the horse, able to see it at this distance as if the dark night were brightened by both of Earth's moons in full splendor. He spied a heavily robed, slender figure lying on the ground beside the horse. Or was it partially beneath the animal? His vision of the form was somewhat obscured from this vantage point. He edged Windeater closer, circling to get a better view, and cautiously drew his dagger just before he identified exactly what was before his eyes. The animal was indeed dead, seemingly from a wound suffered in combat, and the figure was a woman with one of her legs pinned beneath its body. Evidently, she had been unable to free her foot from the stirrup in time when the steed collapsed and died. "You're not going to hurt me," the woman said groggily, phrasing the question more like a statement. Then, in a more panicky tone, she continued, "How did I get like this? Who are you?" It was obvious to Gord that the woman was not seriously injured, but she was disoriented and puzzled. "I'm neither friend nor foe, just one who is glad to be done with fighting," said Gord in response, trying to put reassurance into his voice. "Will you please help? My leg is trapped," she said, a tinge of panic creeping into the statement. "Aid me and I will see that you are rewarded." "No need for reward," Lady Gord replied, dismounting and walking to her. "I will free you, and then we will both be gone from this carnal place." Carnal. And break. And that is a good spot, 659. And this is the end of chapter 7, page 128. And I believe we've run into... I'll talk about it tomorrow. Now, one of the key things I thought that of all this action, there really was not much lore inside of it, but it was interesting to hear Yoli are referred to as Baklunish by the Aradan nomads. Now, it makes me wonder, who are they then, if they do not consider themselves be Baklunish, because Baklunish simply meant everybody in the West, at least as it did to the Easterners of the Flaness. So is this like the Flan, The Flans seem to be composed of various kinds of cultures. The Bakluners seem to be composed of various cultures. Has it gotten to the point where they're no longer seeing themselves as Bakluni, and now that they fragmented, that they really are seeing themselves as one culture and a different culture, and very big dividing line?
Maybe these guys live pretty much exclusively in the dry steppe.
Yeah, and I had thought that I thought the Paynim were the ones supposed to be the dry steppe and plains of the Paynim, but this definitely has the Aradan here, and also some kind of civilization with Carnoush and the mines, and you know, the place where they're selling the slaves and structures, and then these nomads. So we really have you know, something happening here in the dry steppes. And, you know, I love hearing what Gygax has done with this, because there's just so little information that we get about the West.
Yeah, I'm not sure how much of that is enumerated in either the folio or the box set.
Yeah, and unfortunately we are, coming near the Sea of Death, and that is a different kind of land entirely. Once the Sul Imperium, and now a strange and deadly land. It's actually, I think, inspired, when I read this next section, it's inspired by a story by Clark Ashton Smith, which has a land kind of like the Sul land. Well, I'm going to try not to forget to summon up Craig this time, and so that we can shut down everything. So this was recording 10. Everybody keep in mind who's listening, I'm no longer going to be doing Tuesday nights, so it's going to be, I'll be doing 6 nights a week unless something comes up, but I'm not going to be doing Tuesdays. All right.